Antar Babostigan, please.
Leovina spat the name into the phone. I'm afraid Mr. Babostigan is not here. Would you like to speak to Mrs. Babostigan? Leovinus had always felt secretly sorry for the project manager's wife. He could not imagine what it must be like living with such a duplicitous, cold-blooded egomaniac as Antar Babostigan. His pity was only slightly modified by the knowledge that Crossa Babostigan herself was, if anything, marginally more duplicitous, cold-blooded, and egoistical. Perhaps the two cancelled each other out, and the Babostigans lived a warm, intimate, and caring family life. It was a mystery to the great inventor.
"So nice to hear from you, Leo," said Crossa Babostigan.
Leovinus hated it when people called him that, and he knew that she knew, he knew she knew it. "How is the family?"
"I don't have any family, Crossa," said Leovinus, with what he hoped she could hear was strained patience. "Where is Antar?"
I think, in fact, I'm sure he's at the ship. He went there with Druid a couple of hours ago. Some panic about something or other. You know how those guys worry themselves sick over your ship?
Yes, he knew. About the same way an anaconda does over a goat it's just eaten.
Is there somewhere they can reach you when they get back?
Leovinus flicked the phone off. A deep sense of foreboding spread from his thighs up to his abdomen and across his chest into his heart.
Babostigan and Scraliontis on the ship? What the devil are they up to?
The deep sense of foreboding suddenly changed into a sharp stabbing pain in his stomach. He felt cold. He felt sick. He had to talk to the only person that could help. Titania. He made his way down onto the canal level, along the grand axial canal itself, second class, towards the central dome. When he reached the vast statue of Titania that dominated the central dome and the head of the central well, he disappeared into a doorway under one of her wings. A long staircase led up to the vital heart of the ship, the secret chamber of Titania herself. Leovinus had long enjoyed his reputation as the originator of ironic architecture. There was the famous house he designed for Gardis Arbeldonta, the professor of mathematical implausibilities at Bluontis University, in which the doors were actually radio sets, and entrance and egress was gained via the bath. But here on the starship, he believed he had constructed one of his most satisfying constructional ironies. Titania's secret chamber, her central intelligence core, was located in the very middle of the great central dome. It formed the giant chandelier that hung above the central well. The secret heart of the ship was hidden in full view of every passenger and every member of the crew. The chamber itself hung upside down, but it had been surrounded by an inverted gravity field, so that, when you entered it, it appeared to be the right way up. The serrated ribs that traversed the great dome were, once you had entered the inversion field and submitted to the disorienting process of gravity reversal, in fact, long upside-down staircases leading up to the chamber, and the great dome itself was a vast concave floor at the bottom of the immense central well that stretched up above topsy-turvy in an arrangement that bewildered and astonished the first-time visitor. Leovinus sprinted up the staircase, two steps at a time. His mind focused on one thought, Titania, the love of his old age, the obsession of his aging heart. Intelligent, kind, wise, caring, serene, warm, Titania. He burst into the secret chamber and gasped. His head went into a spin, and when you have a mind the size of Leovinus's, a spinning head is a formidable sensation. He vomited. He could scarcely bring himself to look at the horror before him, and yet he could not take his eyes off it. Titania, his Titania, his darling creation, his joy, had been dismembered. She lay there in the centre of the chamber, her hair and wings spread out in their perfect circle around her. But her beautiful, gracious head was grotesquely disfigured. Her mouth had been ripped away, her eyes gouged out, and her nose torn off, leaving a gaping cavity of raw microcircuitry. But before he could even so much as mutter the word fiends, Leovinus became aware of someone else in the room. A figure was crouching behind the succubus console.
Babostigan!
Leovinus ground the word out like a piece of gristle.
What in the name of darkness are you playing at?
Without thinking, Leovinus found himself lunging at the project manager. A small, glowing silver shard fell from Babostigan's grasp and tinkled to the floor. Leovinus glanced down and realized that one of Titania's incredibly delicate cerebral arteries, the central intelligence core of Titania's brain, was lying against his foot.
"We are destroying her!"
Bobostigan pushed Leovinus off him, and the old man staggered back and fell onto the floor, across the outspread wings of his beloved creature. "You're blind, Leovinus. You sit up there in your ivory tower, thinking you're too high-minded and pure to deal with grubby things like business and finance. Well, this whole thing's gone way out of control, thanks to you."
"What do you mean? What are you talking about?"
Leovinus was almost crying.
"This whole project's a financial catastrophe. Didn't you realize that? We're on the brink of a major fiscal meltdown."
Bobostigan was trying to get to the door, but Leovinus, with surprising agility, was back on his feet and cutting off the exit.
"So what are you trying to do?"
But even as he asked the question, Leovinus suddenly saw, with total clarity, the whole plot.
"The insurance," he gasped. "You are going to scuttle my priceless ship and claim the insurance."
"Grow up," growled Bobostigan. "This is the real world."
But he never got any further. The aged genius had hurled himself upon him, hitting the manager squarely on the chin with a remarkably mundane uppercut. Bobostigan lurched backwards, caught his foot in one of Titania's wings, and fell into the succubus tray. The moment he did, the succubus robot was activated. It leant forward, extending its brass snout.
"Always a pleasure to dispose of your rubbish."
And it sucked Bobostigan up. There was an unpleasant crunching sound and a slight plop, and the project manager was gone. The succubus system was a rather controversial part of the ship's design. In an age when telepresence was all the rage, the idea of transmitting objects around the ship quite physically and literally by means of vacuum tubes seemed old-fashioned and retrogressive. But Leovinus had insisted. It was yet another little irony that he cherished. He finally carried the day by using the safety argument. The physical transport was always less risky than teleportation or any pseudo-travel arrangement. What's more, his succubus robots would be able to categorize and sort everything put into their tray. So if you failed to tell them where you wanted your object sending, they would do it automatically. The system, however, was not designed for human beings, and the succubus was supposed to be programmed to reject any living human who might fall into the tray. Clearly this was yet another area where compromises had been made. Leovinus knew, with a queasy tingle, that Bobostigan had become the victim of his own plot, and would now be a condensed cube of detritus on its way to the ship's bilge. And now the full impact of the situation began to come home to the great man. Here he was, the greatest genius the galaxy had ever known, the day before the launch of his ultimate masterpiece, with an unfinished ship, a financial crisis of which he had known nothing, and a dead project manager caught in the act of sabotage. This was not going to look good in the official biography. Meanwhile, where was Scraliontis? Crossa Bobostigan had said her husband had come to the ship to meet the accountant. Leovinus knelt beside the disfigured Titania, and lovingly slipped the silver shard into the nerve centre at the base of her skull. His hand shook as he realized the other artery was still missing. In fact, now he came to look, most of her brain was missing. How had he not noticed that before? Titania's brain, so delicate it was, the slightest shock or scratch could permanently injure it. With a ship of this sophistication, it was especially dangerous to have the nerve center non-functional. There had been recent stories about a new phenomenon, a kind of high-tech metal fatigue, that could afflict certain artifacts which had too high a density of logic systems built into them. SMEF. Spontaneous Massive Existence Failure. Leovinus knew it was theoretically possible, if unlikely. He also knew that practically every molecule on the starship Titanic was in some way part of the ship's logic system. If the thing were launched in its present state, who knows what catastrophe might follow. There was no time to lose. He must retrieve all Titania's missing parts and reassemble them before the unthinkable could happen. Some moments later, Leovinus was to be found in the starboard embarkation lobby, yelling at the deskbot.
"Of course you know, Scraliontis!"
The deskbot, while remaining perfectly polite, was showing no inclination to be helpful.
scrawny little man, glasses. He's the accountant of this whole project, for crying out loud. You've seen him snooping about here thousands of times.
Much to my regret, sir, I have been scanning my acquaintance database and am unable to come up with anyone matching the criteria you indicate. However, I am in a position to offer you a berth on the starboard Supergalactic Traveller E-deck. The rooms are painted pink, and the noise from the disposal unit is hardly noticeable.
I want to know where Scraliontis is.
Leovinus flashed a small gold card in front of the deskbot. Written on the card was the legend 60 Million Club. The deskbot sat up brightly.
Certainly, sir. I would suggest you look for Mr. Scraliontis in the first-class restaurant.
The first-class restaurant was a black-tie-only affair, so the maitre d'bot was understandably shocked when a disreputable elderly man suddenly burst in and shouted,
"Scraliontis, I know you're in here!"
"What an honour to have you here, sir," exclaimed the maitre d' genially. "However, I am sure, sir, would be more comfortable in the second-class brasserie."
"Shut up," said Leovinus.
"Of course, sir, it will be a great pleasure to not only shut up, but belt up, cease to babble, and generally get lost for you, sir. But may I point out that we would be only too happy to oblige, sir, with some appropriate attire, if sir would be so good as to follow me."
Leovinus had spotted Scraliontis, who was standing at the controls of the telepresence robot, trying to fit something into the succubus. He glanced up when he heard Leovinus's voice, smiled thinly, and hid, whatever it was, inside his dinner jacket.
"But sir would surely not want to feel at a disadvantage vis-à-vis the other diners. May I recommend a change of vestment before partaking of cocktails?"
The maitre d'bot blocked Leovinus's path as he headed towards Scraliontis. For a moment the great man lost sight of the accountant, as the robot bobbed and weaved, bowing and nodding in front of him.
"Just get out of my way," growled Leovinus.
"It would be my pleasure, sir, but may I remind you that while smoking is permitted in the first-class restaurant, it is a jacket-and-tie affair, and I am afraid I shall have to call for assistance if sir proceeds any further."
"You're too late, Leovinus," yelled Scraliontis. "This thing is going nowhere, and it's going there tomorrow at noon, fast!"
The accountant always did enjoy talking in elliptical sentences that didn't quite make sense. It gave him the feeling that he was in some way illiterate, despite his occupation.
"Stop whatever it is you're doing," shouted Leovinus.
"Oh, I appreciate your visit, sir, and hope to see you many times in the future, but if you could just lower your voice a touch, I will show you to the exit as soon as possible."
"I said shut up!"
Leovinus suddenly turned on the robot, as it made yet another bow in front of him, and picked it up and hurled it bodily at Scraliontis.
"May I recommend, sir, to the fire exit? I think, sir, we'll find the plainness of the corridors more suited to his current garb,"
remarked the maitre d'bot as it hit the accountant full in the face, sending him sprawling. The object Scraliontis had been hiding fell onto the floor with a tinkle. It was the other cerebral artery of Titania's brain. At the same moment, the robot burst apart on the elegant floor of the restaurant. Scraliontis scrambled to his feet, grabbed one of the robot's legs, and charged at Leovinus. The old man sidestepped, picked up the robot's right arm, and faced the accountant. For a few moments, the two circled each other. Then Scraliontis opened with a straight thrust into an open line. The robot's leg grazed against Leovinus's shoulder, scoring a high outside. Leovinus replied with a simple parry from the fourth position, executing a deft circle with the robot's arm that gained him the right to riposte. But Scraliontis was clearly fencing under a different rulebook, for he went straight to a redoublement, regardless of Leovinus's right to riposte. The great genius was outraged. He flung the robot's arm at Scraliontis, in an attack that certainly didn't figure in any rulebook, and closed in for a corps-à-corps, throwing any pretense to duelling etiquette to the wind. Leovinus now had his hands round Scraliontis's neck.
"Probostigans!" screamed Scraliontis. "Help!"
"Probostigans, garbage!"
The normally kind and mellow face of Leovinus had taken on an evil green hue. This was mainly due to the fact that the lamp of the table on which they were now wrestling was directly under Leovinus's chin.
"He may be garbage," gasped Scraliontis, "but he's got a gun."
"He's dead," yelled Leovinus.
His fingers were beginning to tighten on the accountant's neck. If he'd known Probostigan had had a gun, he would have been a bit more careful how he treated him.
"Ah, you're choking me,"
screamed Scraliontis.
"I know, that's what I'm trying to do."
Leovinus tried to put some conviction into his voice, but he was finding it extremely difficult to make his fingers actually constrict the accountant's scrawny neck. I suppose you could say that Leovinus just did not have the killer instinct. Scraliontis, on the other hand, did. As he realized Leovinus was never going to carry through what he was attempting, Scraliontis had tightened his hand around the table lamp, a conventionalized statuette of Titania with her wings providing the illumination. As he felt the great genius's hands falter around his neck, Scraliontis brought his knee up into Leovinus's groin. At the same time, he raised up the table lamp and brought it crashing down onto that magnificent cranium that housed Leovinus's magnificent brain. Leovinus's hands fell from the accountant's neck. He slumped to his knees. Crack! Scraliontis brought the table lamp crashing down onto Leovinus's skull again and again. The extraordinary and superb mind registered all was not right. It blocked out the pain, then realized something truly disastrous had taken place, and wisely decided to abandon all future contact with the outside world for the foreseeable future. Leovinus rolled over onto the restaurant floor unconscious, with blood pouring from his head. Scraliontis stared down at him. God! He'd killed the great man! In a panic, Scraliontis glanced around the first-class restaurant. Disposing of dead bodies, although not something he'd done before, was the sort of thing his accountant's mind was really good at, and a few moments later he was hurrying out of the first-class restaurant with a spring in his step. In his panic, however, he had forgotten the little glowing silver shard that now lay on the floor mingled amongst the remains of the Maitre d'Ebot. Leovinus was wrapped securely in one of the great curtains that helped give the first-class restaurant its ambience of unadulterated luxury and elegance. While Leovinus had been thus engaged with business matters, the journalist had been trying to pump information out of the workman who claimed to have come on board to reclaim his parrot.
Come on, said the journalist. Nobody's buying that. What are you really up to?
I have a pet parrot, said the workman doggedly, sticking to his absurd story. I always take it with me when I'm working. I know Mr. Leovinus wouldn't allow a bird on board, so I've been keeping it hidden. But when I came back to get it just now, I found that some bastard had opened the door of the cage and it's escaped.
The journalist heaved his eyes heavenwards. He was used to hearing cock and bull stories, but this parrot and bastard one didn't even get off the slippery starting blocks of meretriciousness.
Look, he said, I'm a journalist. I know when there's something fishy going on, and I know that you're hiding something. I'll cut a deal with you.
The workman turned on him.
I'm really very upset. I love that parrot.
You tell me everything you know about the starship, and I'll not tell Starstruck Inc. about the parrot.
They had just reached the central dome area, and the worker was hurrying through the gallery surrounding the central well towards the port embarkation lobby.
Why has the work got so behind? They've been cutting corners, haven't they? Leovinus seemed to be in the dark about it, and all these stories about the financial problems, they're true, aren't they? What's going to happen tomorrow? This ship isn't in a fit state to take off, is it?
That's right, said the worker, as he strode across the embarkation lobby. Everything you say is true.
If you're enjoying your stay on board, why not celebrate with an evening in the Champion Canapé Lounge, featuring canapés from the Orblerontin finals for 6 centuries, called the deskbot.
So, said the journalist.
So, said the worker, turning on the journalist and looking him in the eye for the first time. If you see my parrot, give it this.
He pressed a small metal band into the journalist's hand and disappeared through the main doors. The journalist looked at the piece of metal in his hand. It bore an address and a phone number, which the journalist recognized as that of the Yassican embassy in Blorontis. The journalist spent the next half hour or so exploring the ship on his own. He discovered more unfinished areas. The starboard embarkation lobby, for example, was totally unfinished. Large sections of the second-class living quarters needed decorating, some were even without beds. He noted everything down and returned to the central dome, when suddenly a figure came hurtling round the columns of the gallery and collided with him.
"Drut Scraliontis!" he exclaimed.
"I know who I am," snapped the accountant.
"Just the man I was looking for," smiled the journalist.
"Ah!"
Scraliontis jumped, and his eyes shot guiltily over the journalist's shoulder, as if expecting to see the homicide police with their vicious, trained rabbits pouring onto the starship to arrest the murderer of the greatest genius the galaxy had ever known.
"He's not dead, I swear it!"
"Who's not dead?" The journalist couldn't believe how many juicy stories seemed to be offering themselves up to him tonight. If only he could pin one of them down.
"Who isn't dead?"
Scraliontis now realized he'd made a mistake.
"Get out of my way!" he yelled.
"Not so fast!" exclaimed the journalist.
But Scraliontis had reached a point beyond the bounds of politeness. He shoved the journalist so he fell back against a pillar and started to run. The journalist picked himself up, charged after the accountant, and brought him down in what would have been referred to as a rugby tackle if they had played rugby football on Vlaontin. Scraliontis fought with the energy of a trapped animal. He scratched at the journalist's face and punched and kicked. The two managed to stagger to their feet, still fighting like two snorks in a bucket of snork swill, an old Vlaontinian expression. The journalist, being young and fitter, soon had the accountant backed up against the barrier rail of the great central well. As he tried to restrict Scraliontis' movements, he could see past him down the dizzying depths of the well, down and down seemingly forever, a breathtaking, intimidating, and yet somehow inspiring sight.
"Tell me what's going on!"
The journalist was pinning Scraliontis' arms to his side.
"What's the scam?"
"Scam?" sneered Scraliontis. "You'll never find out."
"Oh, yes, I will," said the journalist.
"Very well, I'll tell you everything," replied Scraliontis,
rather surprisingly. The journalist was totally wrong-footed. He almost said, "Oh, no, you won't," but he fortunately managed to stop himself.
Oh, that's very decent of you," he managed to say.
But he was not fool enough to let go of Scraliontis' arms.
"We're going to blow it up. How's that for a story?"
The journalist was now fool enough to let go of Scraliontis' arms.
"You mean there's a bomb on board the starship?"
"But you'll never find it,"
grinned Scraliontis.
"Because you won't be alive."
And suddenly Scraliontis had something in his hand. The journalist didn't see what it was, but he felt a stab in the ribs. He staggered back, bent over, and looked up. Scraliontis was standing with one of the first-class dining room table lamps in his hand. The sharp, illuminated tip was dripping with blood. At that very moment, however, there was a terrible screech and a flash of colours as a large parrot suddenly hurtled out of the arches straight at Scraliontis. The accountant tried to fend it off, but the creature's wings kept beating at his face, and its beak was tearing at his nose, and the accountant scrambled back against the barrier rail, flailing with his arms and screaming,
"Get it off! Get it off!"
And then it happened. It was one of those ironic moments that fitted perfectly into Leovenis's current architectural style, and gave the journalist his first piece of hard evidence that corners had indeed been cut during the construction of the starship Titanic. Scraliontis had, of course, been the main instigator of the plan to reduce the construction costs of the starship. It had become clear that the whole project could never break even, let alone go into profit. It was, in fact, heading for total, enormous financial disaster. His and Bobostigan's reputations and personal fortunes were both on the line. There was only one clean, simple, rational solution, and that was to scuttle the ship and claim the insurance. The ship was, of course, already heavily insured, and Scraliontis made sure that those policies were beefed up and that all monies repayable were routed through companies owned by Scraliontis and Bobostigan. Construction costs had to be cut to the bone, and building restricted to the merely cosmetic. He had, unbeknownst to Leovenis, instructed contractors to halve and then quarter the specifications of any number of elements on board. One of the materials that had been generously economised on was the metal employed in the barrier rail surrounding the great central well.
"After all," Scraliontis had remarked, "there aren't going to be any passengers to lean on it, so why make it unnecessarily strong?"
The reason, he now realised, was that it might not be a passenger who leaned on it. It might actually be the project accountant who leaned back against it in a moment of forgetfulness while under assault by a parrot. But the realisation came too late. Scraliontis heard the feeble metal crack, and the next moment found himself falling backwards into the abyss. By the time the horrified journalist made it to the broken rail and looked down, Scraliontis was a tiny figure, still no more than a third way down the great central well, turning gently in circles, waving his arms, and shouting up ever more faintly,
"Bloody parrots!"
The parrot in question alighted on the journalist's shoulder.
"Bloody accountants!"
it said. The vicious rabbits had been brought back under control. The overexcited riot police had been calmed down by their chief, and the Yassican protesters lay groaning in mangled, bloody heaps on the ground. It had been a totally successful exercise in crowd management. Flautin Remanquiz saluted smartly as he reported back to the Gat of Vlaontis.
"Everything under control, your magnificent beneficence," he said.
You may proceed with the launch.
But Leovenus is still missing, replied the Gat.
He was extremely concerned that he might miss out on the great photo opportunity of being seen arm in arm with the greatest genius the galaxy had ever produced. It was exactly the sort of thing his sagging poll ratings needed, his publicity agent had said.
Whatever you do, get your photo taken next to Leovenus.
It was, indeed, the single most important thing on the Gat's mind throughout the whole proceedings.
We either regret your ultimate lordship, said the chief of police with another sharp salute. The crowd down there is 50 million. They are getting extremely restive. I humbly suggest that we get this launch over and done with, so my boys can start dispersing them at once. Otherwise, we might all be sorry.
The Gat could see what he meant. The crowd had already closed in over the bodies of the unfortunate Yassican demonstrators, and he could see fights breaking out all over the launch area.
Very well, he sighed.
No, thank you, he added,
as the minor official offered him a fish paste sandwich.
I'm afraid you have to, Your Magnificence. It's all part of the ceremony, whispered the minor official hurriedly.
The Gat groaned and took the fish paste sandwich. The band struck up the Bluonti national anthem, and the crowd all stood on their heads, as they always did as a remark of respect to the monarchy.
Sirs, madams, and things,
intoned the Gat of Bluontis into the ceremonial microphone.
This fish paste sandwich is delicious.
A cheer went up from the crowd. The Gat sighed again. It was such a pathetic ceremony, he thought.
And now it is my privilege to launch this, the greatest starship ever built. Fellow Bluontinians, this is a proud moment for all of us. I name this starship Titanic. May luck be with all who fly in her.
And so saying, the Gat let swing the beribboned bottle of French champagne so that it smashed onto the bows of the ship. It may seem odd that a civilization that had never even heard of the planet Earth, and certainly had no idea of its existence, should use French champagne for such an occasion. The explanation is rather complicated and involves a lot of stuff about time warps and black holes and an intergalactic smuggling ring. If I were you, I simply wouldn't worry about it and just take it as read. So, just as the bottle smashed into the ship, the minor official pulled a cord and the sheeting that hitherto had covered the great starship fell to the ground in a gentle cascade of pink silk. There was a gasp from the multitude. Even a people's used to the sight of great starships had never before witnessed one of such elegant structure, such flawless design.
"Isn't she beautiful?"
sighed countless male starship spotters, scanning their binoscopes over the hull for the registration number.
"Your mummy built that,"
murmured countless unmarried teenage mothers to their infants.
"It's a triumph,"
exclaimed the head reporter, suddenly remembering what his script had written down at this point. There was a ghostly roar, as if of seas beating on a distant shore that lies beyond the horizon of thought, as hugely, magnificently, the fabulous ship eased its way forward from its construction dock. It then picked up speed, swayed a bit, wobbled a bit, veered wildly, and just as the crowd were about to scream out in disbelieving terror, it vanished. Just like that. It had undergone what was about to become famous as SMEF, Spontaneous Massive Existence Failure. In just 10 seconds, the whole stupendous enterprise was over.
"We ought to put the bathroom here and the door over there," said Dan.
"It's terrific," said Nettie, "but I thought the bathroom was going to be there and the door was going to be over here," said Lucy.
Why did he always get it so wrong? Dan always made the effort, and yet, no matter how hard he tried, the things he and Lucy had discussed only the day before entirely eluded him, or came out all garbled.
That's what I meant, said Dan.
It's terrific, said Nettie, but I have to tell you something. She was interrupted by Nigel, who was sniffing around the cellar.
You can smell these centuries of vinous pleasure oozing from the very brickwork, he shouted up. The place is only 180 years old, Lucy shouted back down.
It was built as a rectory, Dan murmured to Nettie.
Terrific, said Nettie. But look, Dan.
You're not kidding.
Dan felt the enthusiasm welling up from inside him, the way it always did when he needed it to.
We're going to have the restaurant here on the right as you come in, not your nouvelle cuisine, but state-of-the-art Californian, and here there'll be a bar.
Lucy gave him a withering look, but mercifully she didn't correct him. Oh, yes, now he remembered. The restaurant was going to be on the left. It had started off on the left, then they changed it to the right, but then Lucy had pointed out that the kitchen would be better on the other side, so they'd gone back to the left. Oh, what the hell was he supposed to remember anyway? Terrific, said Nettie, but look. Her voice trailed off as Nigel reappeared. Nettie looked adorable in her simple Gap T-shirt that didn't quite cover her midriff and a hand-knitted waistcoat. Nigel put his arm round her. "Like what you see?" he asked. "Mmm," said Dan. "I mean the house," said Nigel. Dan couldn't stand that effortless, slimy superiority that his business partner could turn on and off like a hosepipe of cold water. No, wait a minute. Make that ex-business partner. The Top Ten Travel Company was no more. They had just sold it for what seemed to Dan a ridiculously satisfactory amount of money.
"It's just what Lucy and I have always dreamed of, isn't it, Buttercup?" he said.
Lucy hated it when he called her pet names in public, but she'd never told him, so she blamed herself. She could see he thought she liked it, and the minor deception had been going on for so long now that she couldn't see how she could possibly tell him. How long had they been together? It must have been all of 13 years. In fact, since the very early days of the Top Ten Travel Company, when Nigel had chatted her up in a bar on Santa Monica and introduced her to his business partner. Lucy had originally been strongly attracted by the suave Englishman, but as they all got to know each other, she found Dan, the quiet East Coast university man, more real and more understandable. In fact, the more they got to know each other, the more she wondered why on earth nobody could see at first glance what a complete sleazeball Nigel was.
"We're going to call it the Watergate Hotel," said Dan.
"Won't that put off Republicans who still want to bug each other?" asked Nettie. Nigel patted her bottom. "Go and turn the car around, there's a good girl," he said. And Nettie trotted off on her high heels, down the steps of the elegant early Victorian rectory into the night. How can she let him treat her like that, thought Lucy to herself, but said,
"When are you going to sign the final release forms for the company, Dan?"
I'm not sure. Dan seemed suddenly nervous. I don't think Nigel's got them yet.
"The forms should be waiting for us back at the hotel," said Nigel before Lucy could explode.
Exploding was a reaction to Nigel which she found increasingly natural. However, in this case, the fuse was lit, but would keep burning until they got back to the hotel and found that, surprise, surprise, the release forms hadn't arrived after all, and that damn delivery company had let Nigel down yet again. Poor Nigel. He always had some excuse or other. They turned the lights off in the empty house and made their way across the drive in the darkness. Above them, the stars filled the cold night sky with astonishing clarity.
"Why hasn't Nettie turned the car around?"
A twitch of irritation gave Nigel's suavity a razor edge. When they got to the car, they found Nettie squinting through the lens of a single-reflex Minolta that she had placed on its roof.
"Now, what on earth do you think you're doing, bozo?"
When Nigel sounded playful, he was always at his most dangerous.
"Shh," said Nettie, "I'm taking a photo of the house. Don't jog the car." I don't know whether you'd noticed, Einstein."
There was sheer joy in Nigel's voice. He loved ridiculing his girlfriends.
"But it's night."
"Right," replied Nettie, not moving her blonde head so much as a millimetre.
"I'm taking a photo called Dan and Lucy's New Hotel at Night. It'll look great in the album. Maybe you'll frame it in the entrance hall." "You can't take photos at night unless you've got a flash dumbbell."
Nigel opened the car door.
"Hey, you've jogged it." "Get in, brain box, I'll drive," said Nigel.
"Oh, I guess it was long enough," said Nettie to Dan.
"Terrific," said Dan.